a lot of connections between Mount Juliet and Greymere. And of course, now there's a connection that another connection that I love and appreciate. And I love and appreciate Andrew and Catherine and their boys. You know, Mount Juliet will always have, as a part of its history, one of the greatest ministers that in our modern times. We're able to say that Andrew's worked with us as a minister for those 6 years. And I know that you already see the amazing minister that he is, but I can just tell you from experience, you're going to continue to see it, and your love and appreciation will continue to grow. And I'll give you about 2-3 years if you're a slow learner, and you're going to be in awe. You're going to say, that's one of the greatest preachers I've ever seen. Andrew's the whole package, and he does it all very well. I've not met many five-talent men, but he definitely is that. I miss Andrew because Andrew made me a better minister. I did ministry a lot better when Andrew was just a doorway down the hall. And I love and appreciate him, and he's one of my best friends and one of my co-workers in the Lord's work, and I love and appreciate him dearly. Artie and Esther were celebrating their 40th anniversary, and they were flying to Australia, and the pilot came over the intercom, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have horrible news. We have lost all power in our engines, and we're going to have a crash landing." Fortunately, there is one bit of good news out here in the over this ocean. We have spotted an uncharted island, and we're going to try our best to bring this plane down close to that island, and perhaps then that'll leave us an opportunity for someone to rescue us. Well, Artie turns to Esther and he says, "Esther, did you send that $5,000 check to PBS yet?" And she says, "Oh, I meant to do that before we left. I'm sorry, honey, I forgot all about that." He says, "Did you remember to mail the MasterCard bill?" She said, "No, it was right there too, and I forgot. I'm sorry, honey." He said, "What about Visa and American Express? Did you mail those two?" She said, "Honey, I'm so sorry, but why are you bringing that up right before we're probably going to die? Don't bring up the negative things that I've done. I'm sorry." He turned and he gave her the biggest kiss that he's given her in 40 years. And she looked at him. She said, "Well, what was that for?" He said, "There's no doubt they'll find us now." Tonight, I would like for you to think with me about something that if we didn't really give it deep thought, we would say, that's a modern day lesson. See, that's the beauty of the Word of God. It's ageless. It's timeless. Let's study a modern day lesson that's thousands of years old. You know, tonight, someone's eating supper and they're not answering the phone. Not because they're eating supper. They're not answering the phone because they know the creditors are calling. They're not answering the door. And if they're married, their marriage is strained. Maybe they're not married because it's already broken. You see, we live in a time, and if you will be turning to 2 Kings, the 4th chapter. 2 Kings, the 4th chapter. We live in a time that in many ways is not really that different from a lot of other times and time periods. You see, we live in a time where financial stress and strain is usually listed in the top three areas of marital problems. We live in a time just like a few thousand years ago, when our outgo exceeds our income, our upkeep becomes our downfall. We're about to read a story that some of you would know very well. Others of you will probably look at it tonight and say, "You know, if I've ever read that, I'd forgotten all about that." It's a beautiful short story where God reminds us of this great prophet Elisha, but He also reminds us of another man who others might have described as a great prophet. But yet his untimely or unexpected death leaves a widow and at least two sons realizing that they're in trouble. Tonight, if I took one little cup and I set it down here and I took a large 5-gallon bucket and I poured water into that cup, none of you would be impressed. But I want you to imagine that 5-gallon bucket is plastic and it's clear. And I want you to imagine it's sitting here and you can see that it's empty. And you can see that the cup that I'm holding is clear. And you can see that it's full. What would be everyone's expression if I began pouring out of this little cup? And I poured and poured and poured. And before long, I had to stop pouring because I filled the 5-gallon bucket up. And what if we took that same little cup and we set another bucket beside it and just kept pouring and filling it up and pouring and filling it up? You see, what we're about to see, that really happened, except instead of water, it was oil. And what it was to show the power of God. How God can do greater and exceedingly, abundantly, far beyond what we could ever ask or imagine. That's what happens when we put God in stories. That's what happens when we put God in lives. We can just keep pouring out and realize that when we're connected with God, we're connected to an eternal source. We're connected to a fount that never runs dry. We're connected to someone who's not limited by time. He's timeless. He's not limited by power. He has all power. But in this story, we see a man and a woman who, before this story is over with, or really as it begins, their cup is little and their bucket of dead is big. And they try to fill up that bucket of debt and they can't get anything else to come out of their cup. And that story reminds all of us, I'm talking about every one of us, where we are without God. We're in a deficit without God. We don't have enough, and you fill in the blank. We don't have enough of anything that matters if we don't have God. And so this story reminds us of how powerful God is and how powerful He can be in our life, because this woman that just can't take her little bit of money and pay off this huge debt that she owes, by the end of this story, she's able to take her little cup of oil, and because of the power of God, she's able to pour her way by the power of God right out of debt. Let's read this story together. 2 Kings, the 4th chapter. Where's the light in this place since my eyes are bad? Okay, here we go. I'm going to have to get somebody to hold my Bible. A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor is coming to take my 2 sons to be his slaves." Now pause there for a moment. I know we just read that, but let's just elaborate a little bit to make sure that we're on the same page of what's happening in this story. Did you notice that this man that passed away was sons of prophets? In other words, he was a man who was in ministry. Did you notice that she also said to Elisha, "He was your servant"? So not only was he in ministry, but he was in partnership in ministry with Elisha in some way. I don't think she was saying he was your personal servant. Saying that both of you have been in ministry and you've ministered together and he's worked along with you in ministry. You've had the same heart, you've had the same work, you've had the same will. And so she's going to the one that her husband probably no doubt loved and respected, a co-worker. Here's a man in ministry. Here's a man who was a partner with Elisha. Here's a man that we know was married. It was her husband. And we also know that he was a father. He had at least 2 sons. And now we know this. He died. And he died with a debt that this family had created that was greater than what this family could pay off without his provisions as a husband and father. So let's read on now and see what Elisha is going to say in verse 2. So Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you?" That's interesting. We're going to come back to that in a moment. He says to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?" And she said, "Your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil." Then he said, "Go, borrow vessels from everyone, from all your neighbors, empty vessels. Do not gather just a few. And when you have come in, you shall shut the door behind you and your sons, and then pour it into all of those vessels and set aside the full ones." You see, what's happened here is he's letting this woman do the things that she can do. She can go out and collect the vessels. There's no reason for a miracle for that. She can collect the vessels. And then also, this miracle is going to take place. Notice in that last verse we read, "Shut the door behind you." It's going to take place in secret, in private. Can you imagine how this would be a distraction to Elisha's work if the whole town saw what Elisha and God were able to do for this woman? All kind of people that they were not in a situation like this woman was in, but their greed would lead them to distract Elisha, and everybody would be lining up. "Here's my jar of oil. Here are my 100 vessels that I've collected. Make it happen again. Do it again. I'm ready." Can you imagine? Isn't it amazing how our greed for physical and material things so often still, a few thousand years later, still distracts us from the things of most importance? Elisha's going to make sure that that doesn't happen throughout this time in his life. And so, God's going to work a powerful miracle through the instruction that Elisha gives, but it's going to be behind closed doors. All right, let's see how it happens. Look at verse 5, if you will. "So she went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons, who brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out." Are you picturing this? That one jar of oil, she pours it out. Notice her sons are bringing vessels. One jar of oil, this vessel, this vessel, this vessel. Now, notice it doesn't say anything about the boys. Can you imagine their expressions? Can you imagine behind their mama the high fives? "Can you believe this? Never seen anything like this." And notice as it continues in verse 6. "Now it came to pass when the vessels were full that she said to her son, 'Bring me another vessel.' And he said unto her, 'There is not another vessel.' So the oil ceased." Now, what's she going to do? A wonderful miracle has been worked, but she still has debt. What's going to be the solution for the debt? Notice the instruction. A lot is said in this one little verse. So Elisha says to her, verse 7, "Then she came and told the man of God, and he said, 'Go, sell the oil, and pay your debt. And you and your sons live on the rest.'" What a story. What a modern day story. A story where it is still so easy to spend more than what you make. It's so easy to forget that the unexpected is always going to happen. When you woke up this morning, did you have a day? I don't mean exact details. I mean in a real broad sense. Did you have a day kind of like you expected? You got up this morning, you probably thought of some of the major things you were going to do. Maybe it was go to work, or maybe it was run to a couple of errands, and then maybe it was I'm going to go to a vacation Bible school tonight. Did your day kind of go as you expected? Now, most of us in here have lived long enough to know this, but the question is, do we know it? Do we remain aware of it constantly? And that is, all of us are going to have a lot of days that don't go anything like we expected. The first thing I want you to see tonight from this story is that emergencies and the unexpected, they will always happen. I'm not saying they'll happen every day, but I'm talking about in our lifetimes, they're always going to happen. Are you going to be ready for it? I'm not suggesting we can foretell the future or we could be ready for everything. But wouldn't it have been great if this young prophet, when he went out and got his family in debt, wouldn't it have been great that before he did that, what if he said, "Honey, let's sit down and talk about this. You know, we're about to create this debt, but what if something happens to me and I'm disabled? What if, I know this may, we may not think it at the young age that we are now, but what if something happened to me and I died? What would we do, honey? Do we need to create this debt?" Think of how many things we do that later on we look back and say, that was foolish. And it's because we looked at it short term instead of long term. Now there's many things we need to look at that can be the unexpected. But let's just look for just a moment here at the one that's listed here. As strange as it may sound, oftentimes, death hits individuals and families as if it was totally unexpected. Now, I'm not belittling anybody's grief that has lost a loved one. Please understand that. But don't we all have to admit that we all are going to die unless Jesus comes again? Not many heads nodding. Do you not want to admit that? Or is it false? You're going to live beyond Methuselah? No. Everybody here, unless we live until Jesus comes again, we're going to die. And everybody in your family, and all the friends that you have, everybody's going to die. Preacher, what are you trying to do? Depress us? What's the point? The point is this. We always use things more wisely when we recognize that they are limited. We always treasure things whenever we realize that we only have so many of them. There's not anybody here that knows how many days they're going to live, but everybody here knows this. We all are one day closer to friends gathering around a casket and viewing us than what we were yesterday. And we're 1 week closer than what we were last week. And we're 1 year closer than what we were last year. Why is that important? You probably know this, but this isn't some clever line I've come up with. Let's look at a few passages because I want us all to walk out of here tonight knowing God wants you to know that death should never be unexpected. It is a shame for someone to pass away and say, stand on the other side of eternity and say, I never really thought about death. It just really caught me off guard. Can you imagine the waste and the foolishness of life that you're going to make of yourself if you haven't considered life, death, and the value of each day that you have? Turn with me, if you will, to Psalms 90. Psalms 90. Look in Psalm 90, and I'd like for you to look down in verse 12. So teach us. See, this is something that you would think we would know by nature, but see, we sometimes give ourselves too much credit. In other words, we don't know this one by nature. We're going to have to learn this one. So teach us to do what? To number our days. Why? That we may gain a heart of wisdom. When you recognize, I have just come 1 day closer. I need to value tomorrow. I need to make the most of this evening. Tomorrow, maybe instead of the only thing I consider is this righteousness or is this sin, if I value my days, I might even go beyond that and say, I don't want to just choose righteousness. I want to make sure I choose best over good. I want to make sure that I value every opportunity instead of just one good opportunity tomorrow. You know, my wife and I right now, we're having probably the busiest summer that we've had in the 23 years that we've been married. And so right now my whole family scattered across a lot of different states right now. I guess we're in about 5 or 6 different states right now. And so Friday night, we had just come in from a mission trip, and she was about to leave the very next morning. And about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I said to her, I said, you know, we could catch a quick date tonight, even if it was nothing more than just going out to eat. I know you got to get up early in the morning. You think you could do that? And she said, I'd love some Famous Dave's right now. You know what? We only had a block of about 2 hours there. We had the best time. And I would say that one reason why we had such a good time was because we knew that we weren't going to have many of those this summer. When you know something is limited, you treasure the moments a lot more. Be turning back, if you will, to Ephesians, the 5th chapter. As you're turning there, you know, there was a book that came out, a couple of years ago, and we kind of pulled some ideas out of it, and we did a short series at Mount Juliet. And the idea of the book and of that series was, if you had 1 month to live, let that sink in. If you had 1 month to live, what would you do? Is there some experience that you would want to be a part of that you've always said, before I die, what would it be? 1 month to live. Who is it that you would go and you'd make amends with them and you would literally say, I just can't go to the grave with this. I know it's been a long time, but I'm going to make my peace. What is it that you would make right in your life? What sin is it that you turn away from that you've been saying for a lot of years, I just can't seem to get away from that? What is it? If you knew you had 1 month to live, what is it that you would change in your life? What is it that you'd start doing that you've never done before? Would you read the Word a little more? How would you view the sunrise in the morning if you knew you only had 29 more of them to go? How would you savor supper? What would a hug feel like from a family member? If you knew you only had 1 month to live. You see, I think what God is saying to us is that's a pretty good way to live life. The life that you would create if you thought you only had 1 month to live is probably a good way to live the rest of life in most areas and aspects. You see, we see readings and writings like this all throughout the Scriptures. Look in Ephesians, the 5th chapter. Look there in verse 15 and 16. See then that you walk. You know, that's your conduct. See that you walk circumspectly. Now, circumspectly is the idea of literally carefully planting each foot. It's hard for us to picture this just on a nice smooth carpet like this. You picture yourself on a rugged path where you would naturally look at every step because you wouldn't want to twist your ankle, you wouldn't want to step in a hole or step off in a little gully. And you've been on those kind of paths. That's what it is to walk circumspectly, where you say, I am watching every step. And here the plea is for Christians to watch every step in their life. Now notice, see then that you walk circumspectly. Watch every step, because this is what fools don't do. Not as fools, but as wise. Now notice this next line. Redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Place every step carefully, every day. Fools don't do that. But you see, fools don't redeem the time. How many of you have ever collected a few Coke bottles as a kid and went down to the store? Anybody ever did that? Oh yeah. Ice cream sandwiches taste so much better on a hot summer day when you found 3 Coke bottles to get one. Redeem. I've got something valuable, and I'm not going to give it to you unless you give me something valuable in return. You know what? Right now, this evening, God has given you something valuable. Are you going to waste it? Are you going to redeem it? tomorrow morning, if the Lord wills you the rest of that day, He's given you something awesome. He's given you life. Life for that day. Will you carefully place your steps so that you make every use of that day to count for something good? Will you redeem it? Or will you waste it? How many hours do we spend a week on things that really don't matter? I'm not talking about sin. I'm just talking about things that really don't matter. They're really not going to benefit anybody toward eternity. They're not really going to be an act of service and sacrifice toward anybody to convey love or compassion. How many times do we get toward the end of a day and it's not that we've gone out and rebelled in some multitude of sinful acts as much as it's we just kind of walk through the day. What does the Lord want? The Lord wants us to count our days, number them. They're valuable. He wants us to guard our footsteps so that we can redeem. And finally, you remember Ecclesiastes, the 7th chapter? Remember Ecclesiastes 7, that there's that teaching that if we didn't understand spiritual life, it would make no sense at all. But as Christians, we understand this and we say, wow, that is beautiful. I needed that reminder. See there in the 7th chapter in verse 2, better to go into the house of mourning today. What would we call that? A funeral home. So let's just think about that. Better to go to a funeral home than go to a house of feasting. Better to go to a funeral than to a party or to a celebration. Why? 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 For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Look at verse 4 and see the same thing. The heart of the wise is in the house of the mourning, but the heart of the fools is in the house of mirth. What's the point? Solomon says we need to visit some funerals. And when we go in there, we need to be reminded of Hebrews 9 and 27. I have this same appointment. I will also fold this tent, and it will be laid in a casket, and friends will pass by me too. I'm going to be in this very same place. You know what? When I leave this funeral home tonight, I'm going to contemplate life. And I want to contemplate whether or not I'm redeeming it. And I want to contemplate whether or not I'm numbering, I'm treasuring the days. Every day is a gift from God. Let it never be said that death was unexpected for us. If we die this very night, let it be said, I lived every day toward that night. Now we could back up a little bit lighter. It's still important. Let's go back to our story. What was the unexpected? It was death. And how did it leave them? It left them in financial turmoil. You know, today we oftentimes have things that we call unexpected things, and they leave us in financial turmoil. Have you seen somebody that says, I wasn't expecting to run over that piece of metal, and now I have two flat tires, and that's really hurt me this week. I wasn't expecting to have to buy tires. I wasn't expecting to buy a central heat and air unit this summer. I wasn't expecting to have to put another roof on my house. Financially, what's the wisdom? The wisdom financially is to know that the unexpected is coming. And we would be wise, and we could keep our family from feeling the strain that this family was feeling if we will realize that we shouldn't make such short-term decisions. But when we look long-term, we realize there's going to be a lot of unexpected events in life, and I need to be ready for those, even financially. Go back again there in 2 Kings, the 4th chapter. Notice not only was it that the unexpected happened, that he died, but did you notice that very last sentence in verse 1? Notice he's died, the servant has died, but notice this, and the creditor is coming to take my sons to be his slaves. What? That mean man. Can you believe that? This family owes him money and he is still going to come. Has it changed? What can we always plan on when we run that little piece of plastic through the machine? That bill's coming, isn't it? When you go to buy that new car and you sign that financial paper there, what can you count on in the next 30 to 60 days? You can count on that bill coming. What can you always count on? See, it hadn't changed in thousands of years. The creditor comes. And it doesn't matter what has happened unexpectedly in your life. The creditor still comes. What are we supposed to do with that? I need to recognize the fact that usually when the creditor comes, he expects more back than what he's given me. Now, I know there's going to be some of you that say, I don't pay interest. I haven't owed anybody in years. Now you need to become a Christian. Because everybody here is in debt, Romans 13. We owe love to everybody. But maybe you don't owe anybody money, and that's good. That's good. But let's talk to the rest. If you took and added up what you pay in interest a year and what you pay in loan fees in a year and what you paid if you have late fees or any other cost that's associated with that loan, have you ever done that to see what you're paying in a year? And is that really what you want to do with that many hundreds or thousands of dollars? I'm not suggesting to you that paying interest is a sin. I'm really not. I'm just saying we need to be wise. And we need to recognize this basic concept that's been in existence almost since the beginning of the earth. And that is, creditors come and they always collect more than what they gave you. And then we need to be aware of the fact that God expects us to be good stewards. And how many times have we seen a child that's about to start school in the fall and we feel so sorry for them because of the clothes they're wearing? Or we see a missionary come through town and we know the good that they're doing. And how many times have we said, I wish I could give more to that cause. I wish I could help that child. But I just don't have the money. How many thousands did you spend this year in interest? I'm not trying to beat anybody up. I'm just saying, let's be real with ourselves. Maybe if we pay less interest, we could use that very same money to do a lot of good in the kingdom. Money's given to us to be a tool to use for good. It's not given to us to be used in slothful or foolish ways, or to become the very item, possession, that we worship or that we trust in, that we find our good feeling about, our confidence in. It's to be used. It's to be used to take care of us and our family. It's to be used to give back to God. It's to be used to give to others who are in need. How do you see your money? Do you see it as a tool? Do you see it as if you deal foolishly with it, there will always be others there that will take advantage of you and your foolishness? I just want to challenge all of us tonight to be good stewards and realize that the creditors will come. Now, when the creditors come to Christians, what will Christians do? Remember Jesus teaching in the Sermon on the Mount? Let your yes be yes, and your no, no. And anything more than this is of the evil one. And so what do Christians do when the creditor comes? Christians don't have to see that paper. You show me the contract and I'm gonna try to find a loophole in it. No. For a Christian, if a Christian created the debt, a faithful Christian's going to pay the debt. Philippians 4, he gives us a list of things that we need to think about. Remember, it included things like whatsoever things are honest. It included whatsoever things are just. What's fair? What's just? Are you going to treat fellow man in a just way? And it even included whatsoever things are of good report. And then in the very next verse, he told us, do these things. Don't just think about honesty. Don't just think about being just. Don't just think about having a good reputation. He says, go out and live a life that does those things. Listen, we live in a society that's grown very comfortable that if a judge says, I don't owe a man, we're too quick to line up with the man instead of the Almighty God. A judge isn't going to overrule God on the day of judgment to try to figure out if your yes was yes or your no was no. I think back several years ago to something that I haven't heard my family talk about in way over a decade. My sister and her husband got married. And shortly after that, a side business of my brother-in-law's went belly up. He was partners with three, him being a third. And my granddaddy Shannon from Cathy's Creek here in Murray County, I remember he always talked about partnerships. He said, let me tell you about partnerships. He says, you get to split half the profit, and when there's a loss, you usually get stuck with it all. Well, my brother-in-law learned that the hard way. When the business went up, they settled all their accounts, if you will, and it came down to, okay, this is where we are now. And this was back a few decades ago, and so 100 grand is a lot to most of us today, but it was a lot more back 20-some-odd years ago. And so they had a partners meeting. And so my brother-in-law said, we need to talk about how we're going to get our checks into each other so that we can get them in to the one source here to pay this 100 grand off over the next few years. And the two other partners started shaking their head and said, we don't know what you're talking about. And he said, well, we got to pay this debt off. I said, our company's no longer open. I'm not going to pay it off. The company's closed. Run-law said, we signed our names on those lines, and we said we would pay. And they said, you may pay if you want to, but we're walking away from this. One of the men preached every Sunday in a Church of Christ. And so for the next 4 to 5 years, my brother-in-law and sister stayed in the little 900 square foot condo that he had lived in before they got married. They would take her paycheck every week and give their portion to God and take the entire check for 5 years and put on the debt. They paid off the $100,000 for one simple reason. That's what Christians do. Listen, don't go out and tell somebody that you're going to borrow something from them if you're not going to return it. Let your yeses be yes, and let your no's be no. And you say, that's a real good time to think long term. Because you may not want to be paying this back 5 years from now. Well, the time to be thinking about that is before you ever borrow it. And you know, Proverbs twice tells you not to co-sign. You know, a lot of people co-sign out of pride. They had to have my name to be able to buy that, you know. Yeah, you just signed up to pay it off too. No wonder Solomon says, don't do it. Don't do it. What do we learn from this lesson? We learn that the unexpected will often happen, so it really shouldn't be unexpected. Creditors will come whether the unexpected has happened or hasn't happened. So what do we do? Well, remember this miracle took place. And when the miracle took place, it left the woman with a house full of oil. But now, we've already mentioned the fact, notice, God only did for her what she couldn't do for herself. Like, He didn't collect the vessels for her. He told her to go out and borrow the vessels. And then, even once the oil was made, did you notice she still had to go to work? Any of you in sales? Sales is work. What was she left with? She was left with a lot of oil to sell. And so now her and her sons have to go out and they got to sell this. And so what's the instruction? Hey, you got a lot of money. This is a great time to throw a party. You thought about adding on the house? This is a good time to add on the house. Hey, have we told you that interest rates are lower than ever? What was she supposed to do with the money? Notice the first thing in verse 7 that she's told to do. Pay your debt. Somewhere in life, there has to come that time where we say, I'm going to stop accumulating debt and I'm going to start paying down debt. But you can't pay off your debt until you stop accumulating debt. Now, people that struggle with this, and there's some of you here that's going to think I'm being cute. I'm really not. It is a real problem. I've sat down and talked with people that are trying to get out of debt, and those people that are struggling at it, you have to ask them point blank. While they're bragging about this card that they've paid down, you ask them point blank, have you been putting credit in any other places? Well, I did open a couple of new cards this month. But I got this one paid down like an extra $200. Well, it doesn't matter if you paid this one down $200, if you bet $200 over on this other one. There has to be that time where we say, I've had enough of debt. There's got to be a better thing to do with my money than give a lot of it away every year. It's got to be a better way of stewardship than that, because I don't know when I'm going to be disabled. I don't know when I'm going to die. I don't know how that would leave everyone else. So maybe I should be wise. Maybe, and we'll get to this in just a minute, maybe I should be content. And so, today, what I'm going to begin doing is paying off debt. Let's get rid of it. Let's find a peace in, as the proverb says, the borrower is a servant to the lender. Let's have peace in not being the borrower anymore. What's the answer to that? Did you notice that for this to come true, not only did it have to be that miracle, but it also had to be work. They had to work. I want to make this point, and I'll try to make it quickly and move on, but I'm really concerned when Christians speak so negatively of work. Number one, it's a sinful attitude. And number two, it's definitely an attitude that we don't need to conjure up in God's people, allowing them to think that that is acceptable. Listen, if you're excited about retirement, just make sure your grandchildren don't think you're excited about retirement because you hate to work. Work is a blessing. Now, before you jump on and say that was the curse after sin, no. Work being more difficult was the curse after sin. If you go back and look, before sin was ever committed, what was their job? Their job was to tend to the garden. Now, surely here in Murray County, we have some people that have grown gardens. And any of us that have grown gardens, we know that that's work. As a matter of fact, maybe this isn't a good place in this sermon to tell you this, but I'm thankful to tell you that I'm going on like 27, 28 years that I haven't been in a garden. My granddaddy Shannon had either one or two big gardens. My granddaddy Armstrong had a big garden and a big strawberry patch, and if you never noticed, those grow very close to the ground. And we always had a big garden and sometime a potato patch in addition to the garden. Now, you be a boy growing up in that family where every house you went to, you were handed a hoe and told to go out there and work for a while. I always said if I could ever get out of the garden, I would never raise another garden. My wife's a city girl, and she thinks the garden would be the coolest thing. And I've told her, and I haven't backed down. She begged me again this year, and I said, Trace, I'll do a lot for you. But I've already told you, I will never have a garden of my own. I said, I won't stop you from having a garden, and I don't mind you doing whatever you want with your garden, but I am not going to have a garden. I said, all that to say this, a garden's work. God gave Adam and Eve a garden, and He said, I want you guys to take care of it. You tend to it. Now when they sinned, He said, now I'm going to make it harder. I'm going to start putting some thorns on some of that, and it's going to get hard enough, the sweat's going to come out a lot more than what it used to. But here's the point. When life was perfect on this earth, man still needed responsibility. Man still needed to be productive. And isn't it interesting that at the same time that we have people bragging about, I hope I can retire when I'm 50 years old, is also the very same time that we have people that it's real difficult for them to really be productive in the work of the Lord. But hey, if you think work's a negative thing, no wonder nobody, or at least not all, want to work in the kingdom. Because why? Work's a negative thing. Friends, work's not a negative thing. Work is a blessing. You may not want to work at your job to the day you die. You may want to switch where you are productive. But please, please see the blessing of being productive, and make sure that your children and your grandchildren see the blessing of being productive. You want to see miserable people? I'll just call an ace, okay? In my 20-some-odd years of ministry, the people in the church that are the hardest to get along with are retirees that believe that they shouldn't have to do anything. I've worked my time in the church, and I'm going to retire now. I've worked, and we've got our summer home, and we've got our winter home, and we've done our time. Find how that is righteous. Find how that blesses anybody. Instead, let's go over to Ephesians real quick. Let's read a passage there that's so beautiful. Ephesians, the 4th chapter. Ephesians 4 and 28. Let him who stole steal no longer. Pause here. I know a lot of you already know what this is going to say, but just go with me with this for a minute. Well, stealing is a serious offense. All of us probably have had something stolen from us. It is a harmful offense. What do you think would be the solution to stealing? Somebody says, well, you just don't steal. No. Now, there is something that's more of a long-term solution to not stealing. In other words, there's something that is really good. It really blesses lives. And when you don't have it in your life will turn to things like stealing. That may not be exactly like stealing, but it's this kind of life that doesn't want to work, that really gets into some bad stuff in life. And so what's going to be the answer? Let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor. Not a curse, it's a blessing. Let him labor. Working with his hands. Why? What is good, that he may have something to give to him who is in need. Now the pendulum has swung all the way from I'm going to take from somebody to now I'm going to work with my hands, and I am literally going to give to somebody. You may already do this, and I really regret that it took me to my 40s to learn this. You know, back when our economy crashed and there's so many people out of work, Tracy and I talked. And we decided that we were going to pull out just a small percentage from our income, not what we give to God, but we're just going to pull out a small percentage every week and just hang on to it. And when we see a family that's out of work and they're struggling, we just put a little bit. It's nothing to brag of. I'm not bragging. It's just a little bit. We put an envelope and just make sure it gets to them. That kid that doesn't have the stuff they need for school, just make sure it gets to them. And I mean it when I say I regret. I was in my 40s before I regularly gave to people. I want to challenge you. If you're not going to work to give to people that are in need, you are the one missing the blessing. You are the one missing the blessing. Give to God, and give to God a little bit more all the time. You can't outgive God. But then, give regularly. You don't have to see their financial statement to know where they are in this much need or this much need. If you believe they're in need, give to them. And then sometimes they just may need a little encouragement. Give to them. The unexpected will happen, so expect it. The creditor's going to come no matter what. So think about that before we create the debt. The answer is, the solution is, pay off the debt. And did you notice his final line there? His final line is, and live off of the rest. How much? Not more than the rest. See, they had done that before. And so now he's saying, hey, don't do that again. When you pay off the debt this time, live on what's left. Not more than what's left. I want to say something that I know, and me just saying it right now won't change your life. But I hope that it affects you enough that if this touches you, that you'll find somebody that is wise and that is courageous enough to say to you what you need to hear, that you'll listen to this. I want you to notice in that verse we just read there in verse 7, he said, for you and your sons to live off the rest. I'm not saying this because I know anything about any of you. I'm saying this because I know of a crowd this size, there'll be a few that need to hear this. If you don't cut your children off, they will bleed you dry. You can't make enough money to keep up grown children that will not be responsible financially for themselves. And I say that because I love you. And I want to challenge you. I say it because I want to challenge you to love your children. The love that we're to have for our children is agape, and that is, I'm going to do what's right and best for you. You are not doing your child a favor paying their bills when they are at the age that they ought to be a responsible adult. You're enabling them and you're hurting them. They need to live off of the rest, and that's their rest, not your rest. It breaks my heart when a woman or a man comes in the office and they tell me, the story always has different details, but it's always the same. I've kept them up now for 15 years. I've kept them up for 25 years now. But my problem is, I'm running out of money now. And now, I don't know what I'm going to do for the last few years of my life. And I don't know what I'm going to do with them, because they still have a need every month. I could give you the long version, but time doesn't permit. But after a woman had given her daughter that had been an adult for about 25 years. She'd sold one house that she inherited from her mother, and she funneled all of that money to that daughter. She sold her house she lived in. She funneled all that money to her daughter. She had her husband's retirement. She had her retirement at 72 years old, up to about 76. She worked a morning job and a night job. This lady had four checks coming in every month. I went into her cupboard and I opened it up, and I kid you not, she had two cans of food in her cupboard. She was giving her daughter, three teenage children, and a husband who was a lot stronger and healthier than me, all of her money every month. And she came to me one day and she asked if she could borrow money. And I knew she was going to send it to him. And I said, "Can we talk?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "I want to ask you a hard question. When you die," and I called her daughter by name, I said, "what is she going to do the next month?" Oh, she looked at me like I'd pierced her soul. And I just sat there. And she sat there. And after a long time, I finally asked it again. I said, "You're going to die one of these days. The next month after you die, what is your daughter going to do?" And finally, after 3 or 4 minutes, she said what she did not ever want to admit. And she said, "She'll just have to grow up and take care of herself." I said, "That's a lesson you could teach her right now. Real love does not enable irresponsibility. Real love demands what is right and what is best." Listen, God didn't save us for an easy life. He didn't save us and say everything's going to be smooth. But aren't you thankful He saved us and gave us all the answers we need? There's going to be the unexpected. Collectors are going to come, pay off the debt, live off the rest. Simple. You can go to a seminar this weekend and pay $500. Or we can take that right there that God gave us. And I assure you, you're not going to hear anything in the seminar that leaves those principles. Because that's where life is. That's living in the wisdom of God. Let's bow. Most gracious God, we thank You for this great congregation. We thank You for her many years of blessing this community and even Your work around the world. And Lord, we're thankful for so many relationships and friendships that tie back to this wonderful group of people. And Lord, our prayer is that we humbly bow before You and we ask for wisdom. Help each of us to be wise and godly stewards. Help us to be generous and help us to work and to produce and do good for Your cause. Lord, help us to carefully place our steps each day so that whatever our last day is, we will leave this earth to simply step over to the other side and to eventually live in Your presence forever. God, we love You. And we know that we're not worthy. We thank You so much for Your grace. And it's through Your Son's name we pray. Amen.